The nation of Zimbabwe is today generally known as an economic basket case, featuring endemic poverty, periods of starvation, and chronic unemployment. In this video, I want to explore the economic policies enacted by Robert Mugabe that led to all of this. First, however, I want to go back to look at the economy in Zimbabwe before Mugabe came to power. Up until 1964, southern Rhodesia had been part of the British Empire, and it just so happens that the administration kept incredibly detailed economic data. I have obtained a copy of their final report, published in September 1964, and it makes for some very interesting reading. Southern Rhodesia, it turns out, was an almost textbook case for how to run an efficient, healthy, growing economy while keeping a balanced budget. As you can see here, from 1954 to 1963, there was a 65.8% increase in export revenue, while they reduced reliance on imports by 23.2%, so that the country was in a trade surplus. There was a steady increase of non-African migrants, mostly from Europe and Asia. You can see that by 1963, there were over 88,000 of them working in various industries. However, the vast majority of industrial workers were local Africans. As you can see, for most of the decade, around 600,000 were employed. The non-African workers were generally very well paid, and that is because many of them were direct investors, especially on the farmlands. Foreign companies accounted for 75% of total agricultural corporate profits and 61% of gross capital formation. Other non-African workers, especially Asians, were brought in as skilled labour and as foremen, and similar supervisory roles. They were naturally paid much higher wages than the local population, owing to their higher productivity and the fact that they paid much higher prices in pounds sterling in the so-called European economy, as opposed to the local African economy, which would have used a local currency, in which prices were a fraction of what non-Africans would have paid. In fact, this two-tier dual economy between locals and Westerners persists in many places in Africa even today. I would also note that the average African worker employed in European-owned industries experienced a 78.1% increase in wages in just 9 years from 1954 to 1963, as compared with a 37.6% increase for non-African workers in the same period. I don't think a 78% pay increase in under a decade is anything bad. In fact, these urban industrial workers were incredibly better off than many of their fellow natives, as we shall see. And just to show, one reason for these pay increases was because GDP almost doubled in this period, rising from £161.5 million in 1954 to £306.3 million in 1963. This was helped by the incredibly balanced budget that the British administration kept, maintaining a surplus in every single year, something which very few governments seem to be able to do today. Now, some of you might be thinking that the number of these workers in this data is quite small, and that is because the total population of southern Rhodesia around this time was 6 million people, almost all of whom were local Africans. So where were the other 5.4 million people? What were they doing? They were not all unemployed, but rather many of them were working in the so-called peasant economy. Traditionally, the economy of this region was divided into European and African agriculture. The former brought more modern farming methods, while the latter more or less carried on as they had always done, using indigenous methods. Tribal trust lands covered around 40% of the total area of southern Rhodesia, and these were still run by traditional chiefs, virtually untouched by the British. There were other areas set aside for natives to farm on themselves. These were called native purchase areas, which had been established in 1930. The peasant economy was spread across these two different types of areas, and around 70% of the population relied on this, largely at subsistence level. Some of these native areas suffered from unemployment and low productivity. In the 19th century, the peasant farms dominated grain production, but these were overtaken by European-style farming after World War I, and by World War II, African production of grain had faded into insignificance. One issue is that Africans could not afford to buy the land set aside for them in native purchase areas. Incidentally, the native purchase areas were very successful in their own terms. By the 1960s, they accounted for one-third of African agricultural output, even though they were totally only 2% of African farming households. So, in 1951, the government passed the Native Land Husbandry Act, which introduced individual tenure under government control in the tribal reserves, emphasizing individual responsibility, and this did make a contribution to increased grain production in the 1950s. Native grain production increased for two reasons. First, international grain prices made imports more expensive, and second, the European farms were switching from grain to the more lucrative tobacco market, which led to an increase in demand for the African farm grain. However, the Native Land Husbandry Act was actually an attempt by the British to create a native middle-class population consisting of an urban elite and a larger land-owning peasantry who would become a rural elite. In fact, the British administration spent over £15.8 million on this in the decade of the 1950s. One reason for this was to offset overpopulation in the reserve areas, which was causing soil erosion, especially since the European agricultural sector was in full employment. If you look at the policy, it is largely assimilation of private land ownership, upheld by property rights for the natives. However, for whatever reason, they were largely resistant to these proposed changes, and this policy was abandoned in the 1960s. One issue they had was that male absentee rates, that is, men who would abandon their families, reached over 50% during this period. This meant that in many cases, they were relying on single mothers with dependent children to sign for this land. They were supposed to receive between 57 and 67 acres per family, but take-up was very minimal. By 1963, only 0.15% of land had changed hands, and a quarter of the entitled families were landless. Besides, the rise of the aforementioned rural and urban native elites was starting to cause a problem for the white settler population as they began to vie for political power. These were the conditions under which Ian Smith unilaterally declared independence from the British Empire in 1964, and Rhodesia became, for 15 years, a rogue nation which was not internationally recognised. Let us fast forward now to 1979, when Robert Mugabe rose to power, overthrowing Ian Smith and the white minority after a bitter civil war called the Rhodesian Bush War. Mugabe was nominally a Marxist and a socialist, but the base of his support was the rural peasantry, which he fueled by nationalist populism mixed with anti-white and anti-colonial rhetoric. Mugabe formally took power as Prime Minister in 1980, and he launched a radical set of economic policies from the start. He introduced a minimum wage, administered price controls, he made legislation making it virtually impossible to fire workers, a 60% increase in public sector expenditure, which included many state schools and the universal healthcare system, high tariffs on imports, and a license system for new investments in which all private sector investment had to be rubber stamped by the government. Mugabe's 1980s policies tend to be described as a form of corporatism typical of social democracy. What were the effects of these policies? First, there was white flight. Many skilled white workers emigrated. The tariffs raised the cost of industrial produce, which damaged the export economy. Foreign direct investment plummeted because of the licensing rules and because administrative controls effectively crowded out investment. there was a chronic budget deficit, and the minimum wage laws and prohibition of firings represented very high opportunity costs for employers, producing unemployment. There was another overall effect of these constraints, which is that they favoured existing capital-intensive and largely white producers, who were also discouraged from taking on additional labour by the controls over wages and employment. This had two politically significant consequences. First, it suppressed the emergence of a genuinely entrepreneurial African business class and reduced the political support of those that did make it their way, despite these problems. Second, it turned unemployment into a major threat to the legitimacy of the regime, especially in urban areas. Wages were actually allowed to decline over the decade, so the minimum wage probably did not discourage employment, although controls over dismissal almost certainly did. In fact, Zimbabwe, even before the Mugabe regime, had a very large informal employment sector, that is, people who are effectively working but outside the formal legal structure. People can work informally as tailors, carpenters, traders, cooks, taxi drivers, any number of things, but they are not captured in official statistics. Here in the UK, we'd call it the black market, but these practices are so common in African countries that it would be meaningless to use that term. But this tendency is massively exacerbated by the sorts of bureaucratic employment demands enacted by Mugabe in the 1980s. However, despite all of this, Zimbabwe had GDP growth of around 7.1% for the 1980s. This is partly because international sanctions, which had been imposed on the unrecognized Rhodesia, had been lifted. But because of those sanctions, the Rhodesian economy after 1968 became diversified to substitute for input goods, which they could no longer get. In fact, between 1965 and 1974, Rhodesia saw 7% GDP growth. This was disrupted by the civil war, but in many ways you can see Mugabe simply inheriting this old economy with a very similar rate of growth. However, this masks the fact that by 1989, Zimbabwe was facing an economic crisis. Here is Mugabe himself on the matter. Employment creation has averaged a mere 10,000 jobs per annum over the 10 years of independence, far short of the planned target of 144,000 per annum. Investment levels fell in real terms from 15.5% of GDP in 1980 to 10.7% in 1989. In the 1990s, Zimbabwe came under international pressure, especially from the IMF, to bring its spending under control and to liberalise its heavily protectionist economy. Perhaps because he recognised that his policies hadn't worked, Mugabe largely welcomed this. However, while protections were removed and wage and price controls relaxed, Mugabe was unable to reduce his deficit spending, which was exacerbated by three droughts in 1992, 1993 and 1995. It's safe to say that Zimbabwe did not have a very good 1990s. The liberal reforms combined with the droughts saw a short-term shock similar to those in Eastern Europe when they were trying to liberalise after communism. As manufacturing was hit and production fell, a sizeable trade deficit opened up. Despite a recovery after 1996, GDP per capita was actually lower in 1999 than it had been in 1990. However, there was some cause for optimism in 1997 because after this difficult transition period, GDP growth hit 7.3% in 1996, and exports had increased from 23.1% of GDP in 1991 to 36.1% in 1996. There was also a sharp increase in foreign direct investment, which rose to $51 million in 1996, which was 70% higher than the 1980s peak. Had Zimbabwe stuck to this course, this would likely have continued. However, the period of transition had caused some political unrest, and Mugabe simply lost patience. He reverted to his former corporatism, making large payments to war veterans that undermined fiscal discipline, land appropriations, policy reversals on taxation and prices, and a decision to send the Zimbabwean army to Congo in 1998, which the country really couldn't afford. Zimbabwe defaulted on its loans from the IMF, the World Bank, and the African Development Bank in 1999. Corporatist controls over the exchange rate and many other prices were re-established, and this destroyed the viability of many firms and reduced the incentive to invest. It also led to capital flight and the near total withdrawal of foreign direct investment. Violent expropriations of white farms followed. As a result, GDP fell by about 40% between 2000 and 2007. Inflation was more than 165,000% by the beginning of 2008. To give you an idea, 50 billion Zimbabwean dollars in 2008 was worth only 198 US dollars. Food production reduced by 50% and industrial output by 47%. By 2007, the poverty rate was at 80% and the unemployment rate, one of the highest recorded by any country ever, was at 95% by 2009. So what then? Zimbabwe had little choice but to dump its own currency and adopt the US dollar, which was already largely being used on the black market. But aside from that, Mugabe essentially doubled or even tripled down. In 2007, he signed the Indigenization and Economic Empowerment Act, which gave indigenous Zimbabweans the right to take over any foreign-owned company. An indigenous Zimbabwean is defined as any person who was born before the 18th of April 1980 who was disadvantaged by unfair discrimination on the grounds of his or her race, and any descendant of such a person. Over 51% of white-owned companies in the country would be transferred to indigenous Zimbabwean ownership. Mugabe sought to offset rising prices with even more stringent price controls and actually sent the police to force shopkeepers to sell stock at a loss. He also doubled the size of the civil service. That's right, doubled the size of the civil service. Let's have a look at the effect of this madness. Debt hit over 200% of GDP. A nurse's daily salary at one point was said to be just 12 US cents, less than the price of a soft drink. Endemic currency shortages led to the government forcing banks to limit cash withdrawals. Shop shelves were often completely empty. Many foreign companies, including Heinz, KFC, and Tetra, simply shut up shop and left the country. There are endemic petrol shortages, and queues apparently stretch for miles. Now, Mugabe might be gone in 2019, but many of these same problems remain. From what I can see, his replacement, Emmerson Mnangagwa, seems to have no intentions of abandoning Mugabe's command and control style of economic management. Just last month, in January 2019, he announced a 150% increase in the price of fuel, which led to widespread protests. He was actually the mastermind behind the Indigenization and Economic Empowerment Bill and was in positions of power in the Mugabe regime from 1980 onwards, which meant that he was one of the people responsible for much of what I've discussed in the rest of this video. I dread to think what is going to happen next. As I said when discussing Venezuela, you can decide whether or not this is real socialism. But what is striking is how many of the policies are exactly the same. Price controls, currency devaluation, punitive state controls on business, endemic deficit spending, land redistribution, and a basic failure to uphold private property rights. the name matters less than the policies themselves. Do not let it happen in your own country. Now get out.
And a very special thanks to Sir Percy Blakeney, The Crimson Satyr, The Ambivalent Onion, Andy Swainson, Bailey in Aurora, David Vacherche, Christopher Scholholm, Natural Rights, Binary Surfer, Holy Spatula, Hornito Jones, Kazga, Michael Tynan, Time Stealer, Toyotomi Ami, Tragic Vision, William Angus, Blake Barrows, and Edward Darrow.